We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Well, I suggested to you last week that Ecclesiastes has lots of good reasons for studying it. Part of the Bible, of course, would be sufficient in itself. But what we can do in studying Ecclesiastes is to really look at the lies of our world. And it's good for us who aren't Christians to be doing it, because it's so easy for us to get caught up in the busyness of life that we don't stand back and actually question what life is about. And it's so easy for us to be really conned into the lies that this world portrays in its busyness, that to really not face up to the truth of God. For those of us who are Christians, it's also very valuable to do, because we keep on, though we've accepted the Lord Jesus Christ, we keep on being conned and tricked into the things of this world. We keep being dragged back into them and distracted from living for God as we have committed ourselves to live for Him. And so Ecclesiastes it's not the most pleasant book in the Bible. In fact, in many ways, it's about the most unpleasant, because it is just so depressing as it wades its way through meaninglessness. But it keeps on taking away from us the false gods, the false ideas, the false values that we would live for, and especially it keeps on challenging us that the alternative to God is nonsense, is meaninglessness. A view which many people, not many, but significant people who do not believe in God also hold. The atheist from the theatre of the absurd, from the whole view of existentialism, will see that life is in fact meaningless. Ecclesiastes is doing no more than driving home the point that the atheist does, but of course many of us who live in the kind of eclectic thought form of 20th century Western university life, eclectic meaning you collect up a bit from everything and you believe a bit of everything and a bit of nothing, we collect up a little bit of atheism, because a little bit of atheism is very helpful to us. It means that we're not answerable to anybody but ourselves, and we like that little bit of atheism. But we will not collect up the full baggage that atheism gives, that if we're only answerable to ourselves, then our life is profoundly futile, meaningless and stupid. We don't like that bit, but Ecclesiastes won't let us collect up the little bit we like and leave the rest of the baggage out. Ecclesiastes says, no, you want that. You want life under the sun, as it talks about. It doesn't use the word atheist. You want life under the sun as opposed to life under God. Well, then face the full consequence, the full baggage load of meaninglessness. This little passage in chapter 3, and we will look at the second half of chapter 3 before the study finishes, God willing, this little passage picks up on the subject of time. And in many ways, this is one of the most unusual apologetics for Christianity and for theism and for God that you will hear. And it's such an unusual one, I think some people find this a fairly difficult study. And it requires some concentration, because it just is a little odd. But it's here in the passage. I don't think it's the oddity of my mind that I'm bringing you. It's the oddity of the passage. And so we need to be looking at it fairly carefully. For centuries, people have been puzzled over time, and some enter into fairly deep speculative, philosophical, mathematical and physics kinds of ideas. What is time? What is the character of time? What is the nature of time? But even if you don't enter into it at that level, most people ponder it somewhere along life. The chances, the changing times and tides. A week is a long time in politics, is a discussion of time. Time and timing and timeliness is one of those odd things of life. I don't know whether you've noticed it yet. I presume you have. Some of you are old enough that you have. But have you noticed that Christmas comes around quicker each year? That your birthday comes around quicker each year? Now, you know that's not true, but at the same time, it certainly seems to, doesn't it, all the time? There is a standard, objective state of 20 year, 1 year, 365 days and all the rest of it, but yet our consciousness of time keeps on changing as we ourselves age. Unconsciously, though sometimes consciously, people adopt a model of what happens over time. History, if you like, what happens over history. Last week I pointed to you from chapters 1 and 2 to a fairly cyclical view of time, that what is happening is what has happened before and what will happen again. That what happens over time is nothing much, really. It's just time's like a cycle. It's like a wheel. It's going round and round and round. The events of life are just going around and round over time. And so the whole of time has that kind of cyclical pattern. What has been, is, and will be again. You can get it in a fairly sophisticated form, like the Stoics of the ancient world, who believed that the whole of time recurred every 5,000 years. That if you turned up here 5,000 years, well, in fact, you will turn up 5,000 years from now and you'll be listening to me give the same lecture. But that is just the character of the world, that the whole universe just goes around and round, and that there is a certain fatalism to what is taking place. And what the Stoic is trying to do is to attune himself to the world spirit, the world course, which has this big cyclical character to it. And what you've got to do is not fight against it. There's no point fighting against your fate. It is going to happen anyway. And so the Stoic is a very passive person. We know the Stoic is the person who would suffer pain gladly, but it's not suffering. They weren't masochists as such. They were people who saw fighting against fate as futile, because the world is on a grand cycle and you may as well just attune yourself. You may as well get with the force, so to speak. But you get it very much more simple. You don't have to go to those sophisticated levels. I met up with a lady down at a corner shop that I used to shop at many years ago, and I called in there because I was just passing by this corner shop, and we had a little chat with each other about life and the universe and the meaning and Ecclesiastes, so to speak. And she talked about her kids and what had happened to them, etc. And I talked about my parents and what had happened to them and so on. And so we had this little chat, you see. And her conclusion on life and its meaning was fairly simple. She said, it's very simple. You're born, you procreate, you die. That's life. That was for her. She'd been born, she'd procreated, and she was going to die, which, seeing the shops now closed, I think she has. But her kids, they're procreating before they die. And their kids procreate before they die. And there's a cyclical view of life. But there are other views of life that you can have. There's the historical determinist kind of view that you get with Hegel, H-E-G-E-L, Hegel, and from him, Marx, and the whole kind of school of historical determinism, whereby life actually has started somewhere and is now moving to somewhere else. And like the Stoics, there is a kind of determinism, there's a kind of fatalism about it. It is going to happen in the Marxist theory. There's no way you can avoid it, but it's not going to finish where it started. It's going to finish in a utopian state where everybody will share all their goods and all their labour equally in fairness and justice and righteousness and so on. But it's all moving there. But with Hegel and Marx, it's a little bit more sophisticated, because they say it's not just going in a single line. It's going in jerks and starts and backs. In fact, they talk of it in terms of the thesis, and then the opposite thing that rises up against it, the antithesis. And from the antithesis, there works out a synthesis between it. And so the world keeps on going like a yo-yo. That's their, I think, the image of time. You know, yo-yo, you can bounce it up and down and up and down and up and down and up, 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 and it finally comes up into your hand. Right? But the exertion down is part of the coming up the next time, and as it comes up, it goes down again and comes up and goes down until finally it comes all the way up into your hand. So is history, from a Marxist kind of view, that every time a great movement takes place, then an equal opposite movement will rise up against it, and there'll be a seeming setback until there's a resolution. But the new resolution is the new thesis, to which another antithesis rises up against it, and then there's another synthesis, which is the next thesis. And so life is getting somewhere. And their setbacks don't matter to them, because that's just part of the antithesis before the next synthesis. But the Marxist has a very clear view that the world is going somewhere and they are part of the process. Be it in victory or in defeat, they are part of the process that inevitably we're going to. But there are other people who take a completely different view. The existentialists say, no, 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 it's all meaningless. The world's going nowhere. It started nowhere, and it's going nowhere. It just is. We are just part of a cosmic accident. And in this great cosmic accident, things happen. And other things happened, and other things happened, and other things happened, and other things happened, and well, the happenings happen, and that's all there is. And to really write an existentialist history is a contradiction in terms. I mean, what happened yesterday is of no real significance, because significance is in the mind of the significator. I mean, it just doesn't exist. And if you wanted to write, you could write up, you could write up the maiden names of all the Australians who were born in the year 1943. That's about as meaningful as writing up a history of the Second World War, because there were things happened. One thing after another happened. It just doesn't matter. And H.A.L. Fisher was not an existentialist, but the meaninglessness of history comes out. Now, he was a professor of history. He wrote a very thick book called The History of Europe. And in his preface, he says, "One intellectual excitement has, however, been denied me. Men wiser and more learned than I have discerned in history a plot, a rhythm, a predetermined pattern. These harmonies are concealed from me. I can only see one emergency following upon another as wave follows wave." See, what's the great story of history? There isn't one. That's what he's saying. Professional historian saying it, a man who's now going to inflict his story of 600 pages on you. But there isn't a pattern, there isn't a story in the history. There is just waves, that's all. And waves don't go anywhere. You know, it looks like, as you look at the water, you think the water is rolling into the beach, don't you? But it's not. Each particle of water is just going up and down and up and down. It's actually not coming in. It never comes in. It's just going up and down. And that's why you can do the Mexican wave out in the cricket ground or at the football ground, isn't it? Because it looks like there's a movement going around the crowd, and in a sense there is a movement, but the crowd's not moving. I mean, it is, it's going up and down, but it's not actually going anywhere. Well, so is history. It's just like there is an event, and there is an event, and here's another event, and there's another event, but actually nothing actually has happened. No one has gone from anywhere to anywhere. There's just a series of events that have taken place. And that's all that it is, that it's not meaningful in the slightest. It's meaningless, what has taken place. On the other hand, you can get people of a more humanist bent, although I think Fisher was actually humanist rather than existentialist, he just had an existentialist view of history, a more humanist bent which actually sees that things are happening, that man is the measure of all things, as the old Greek Protagoras said, man is the measure of all things, and that there is a rhyme, there is a meaning, there is a purpose, although the humanist has a terrible problem. Humanists are the most intellectually difficult position to live in, because you believe there is no God, and yet you believe there is a meaning. And it gets very difficult to hold those two things together. Ecclesiastes is written against the humanist viewpoint. But the humanist wants to say, no, we're getting somewhere. We're making progress. There's an evolution, there's a development. Notice the word evolution and development nearly always is positive in the way in which people use it, which of course it needn't. The words needn't be positive. Some evolutions can be downwards. Some developments can be downwards, can't they? In the end, is the whole of the universe gathering up to a greater and more sophisticated, complex structure? Or is it developing into entropy, into actually the dissolution of all things? Well, we don't know, and fortunately, you and I are not going to live long enough to find out either anyway. But development doesn't always have to be from the lower to the higher, but most humanists always think it is, because they're the last thing on the scene. And you see, if you think that you are the meaning of life and you are the last thing on the scene, then quite obviously the world is getting better, isn't it? Because you're the last thing around, aren't you? And so they have this terrible arrogance. Mr. Bronowski was a mathematician, physics man who turned into a kind of public poet and the rest, and he produced a series of television shows for the BBC back in the 1960s, early 1970s, the title of which tells you where he's coming from. It was supposed to be about science, but he said science is really in the heads of humans, and so it's really about humans. And the title was The Ascent of Man. Pre-feminist, as you can see. Towards the end of the book, he wrote, 50 years from now, if an understanding of man's origins, his evolution, his history, his progress, is not the commonplace of the school books, we shall not exist. The commonplace of the school books of tomorrow is the adventure of today, and that's what we're engaged in. And I am infinitely saddened to find myself suddenly surrounded in the West by a sense of terrible loss of nerve, a retreat from knowledge into what? Into Zen Buddhism? Into falsely profound questions about are we not really just animals at bottom? Into extrasensory perception and mystery? They do not lie along the line of what we are now able to know if we devote ourselves to it, an understanding of man himself. Now there is the end point of the high water mark of science and technology in the Western civilization. Bronowski's kind of was just beginning to see what has happened in the last 25 years, that is a great loss of confidence in the idea that through science and technology mankind is going to be able to rule the world and understand everything. For the more you get to know, of course, the more you discover you don't know. But at that point in the late 1960s and in the early 70s, we really thought we knew it all, or what was left to find out was so minuscule as to really only take a few minutes' time. But we just had to press on. In fact, in 50 years' time, 25 which have gone now, in 50 years' time, the great discoveries of today will be the children's books in the school classroom. Here is his view, a view of the ascent of mankind out of the primeval sludge into the brilliance of academic establishment and atomic war. Now, another alternative altogether in time is what is here. I've given you three things, three or four different views of time, to give you a backdrop to understand that what is being said here is of the significance that it is. This time that he has got is oscillation. It's the oscillating view of time. It's the pendulum view of time. There's a time for this, and there's a time for its opposite. You hear media journalists talk about it like this, and then they talk in terms of backlash, and they talk about the swing of the pendulum. And so there is a time when society is very permissive, and then there's this backlash, and the swing moves to the other direction, and we have a very restricted, legalistic kind of society, which then opens itself up to another very permissive society. And history is this swing of the pendulum from one thing to another. And what Ecclesiastes is saying is even in your lifetime it's like it, isn't it? There is a time to be born and a time to die. There's a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal. There's a time to tear down, a time to build. Each of them is the reverse of the other thing, and each of them has a time about it. And you say, well, why is he saying it? He's saying it because not all time is the same. And so he's actually making a very profound statement that most people miss because they haven't heard just what you've heard about. But he's saying that time is not meaningless. That times and seasons are not identical. That one day is not the same as another day. That the events of one month are not the same as the events of another month. There is a time for doing this activity, and there is a different time for doing that activity. And we can see that there is a timeliness about these activities so that every day is not the same. Now you can say, well, every day is the same. I get up, I eat, I wash, I go to bed. Every day has the same pattern to it. But no, he's saying even within a day there is a time for getting up and a time for going to sleep. That your events actually have some meaning to them by the way in which you can see the seasonality, the timing of them, and therefore there is a thing called good timing, fitting moments, appropriate actions for the occasion. There's a right time for certain actions and another time which would be a wrong time for exactly the same actions. And therefore the rightness or the wrongness of the action is not caught up in the action, it's caught up in the timing of it. Because if it's right sometimes to tear down and right sometimes to build up, then you can't say that building up is always right and tearing down is always wrong, because there is a time for it. In other words, we have some value system outside the events themselves. There is some indication here of values, of purpose, of meaning that we have. Let me try it again. If the existentialist atheist is right that we're all a big accident, then whether I kiss you or kill you is a matter of irrelevance. And whether I kiss you or kill you on a Wednesday is also a matter of irrelevance. It doesn't matter when I go to war or when I declare for peace. Because what you do is what you do. It's all just what you do. That's all it is. But as soon as you say, no, this is not the time for peace, this is the time for war, you're saying there are values. It does matter what you are doing. There is some rhyme, there is some purpose, there is some way in which it can be established that this is right, this is wrong. Good timing is fairly important because it establishes meaning, purpose. But yet, verse 9, but what does the worker gain from all his toil? It's the same question as chapter 1, verse 3. You work under the sun, and at the end of your work, you've got no profit. For although these great moments are, that's the right thing to do today, this is the right time in which to do that, although there seems to be a time and a purpose, it actually goes nowhere. So he's not like the existentialist who says every event is as meaningless as every other event. But he's not like the developmentalist, be it the historical determinism of Marx or be it the kind of wishful optimism of the humanist. He's not like that either because he's saying it goes nowhere. That's why I say it's like the pendulum or the clock. Every time undoes the other time. As there is a time for love, so there's a time for hate. As there's a time for war, so there's a time for peace. As there's a time for sowing, so there's a time for reaping. Every event actually undoes the other event. And so in the end of the time, all you've done is swung a lot. You actually haven't got anywhere. It hasn't developed. It hasn't increased, hasn't decreased. It's just swung like a huge pendulum. What gain is there under the sun? And that's the burden of the poem. That's the burden that God has given us, that this view of time is tyrannous. It puts us under a terrible tyranny. Because from the sense of timing, we can see that there is a meaning and a purpose, and yet from the same sense of timing, we can see it goes nowhere. And so we say, yes, there is a rhyme and a reason to life, but I don't know what the rhyme or the reason is. That's the tyranny I'm going to work on under points A to F, under point 3 there for a few minutes to help you see. See, in verse 11 he says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. Everything is beautiful in its time. That is, things are not beautiful in themselves, they're beautiful in their timing. Sowing is beautiful, but not at harvest time. Harvesting is beautiful, but not at sowing time. Everything is beautiful in its time. And so, take verse 8, that's as hard as any, isn't it? A time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. Hate, war, yes, they're beautiful in their time. Now, it's easy to see love is beautiful, it's easy to see peace is beautiful, but God is saying, no, hate is beautiful if you do it at the right time. And war is beautiful if you do it at the right time. When you read of a dreadful event that happens in our cities, like a pack rape of some poor teenage girl. That is a time for hate. Hatred of man's inhumanity, of the barbarity and immorality, of the self-centered piggery of young men who should and could know better. That is a time when to say, well, I love all teenage boys, doesn't matter what they do, is a nonsense. That's not a time for loving. That is a time for the action that comes from hate. See, there was a great time for war. 1939 was a time for war. It was a good war. It was a right war. For the barbarity of the Third Reich, the barbarity of killing millions of Jews, of that kind of, as we would now call it, ethnic cleansing, the horror of that maniac who was running the country, who wasn't insane but just immoral, the expansionary efforts that he was putting through Poland, through Austria, through Czechoslovakia, the intentions of that man and in world domination of such immorality, that was a time for war. That is when war is beautiful. Oh, the sticking of the bayonet in the gizzards of another man in one sense is never a beautiful thing. It's an awful, always an awful thing. But yet it is something that you would say it's right and good and go and do it. At this time, but not at that time. It was the timing of it which is essential to make it beautiful. That's what's being said. Everything in its time. But God has given to humans in this sense of time, and I picked the hardest ones. If you can pick the hardest ones, the easier ones will be simple, won't it? Right? God has given us in this sense of, yes, there is a, things are right at the right time and wrong at the wrong time. God has given us in that sense a sense of eternity in our hearts. Chapter 3, verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in his time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. That's what I take as being. That sense of, yes, it is right, it is fitting, it is proper, that there is more to life than just day after day, actions after actions, meaninglessness after meaninglessness. That instinct, that intuition, if you want to move to that philosophical school, of timeliness is that sense of eternity. For if you don't have eternity, if you only have this world, well, whether Hitler shoves Jews in gas chambers or not doesn't matter. What's the difference? You're going to die anyway. I mean, why not keep the old boy happy? If that's what turns him on, he's powerful enough to do it. It's, you know, just getting rid of twitching matter and organisms of different kind, organisms that are no different to any other organisms other than they've evolved out to be humans, in particular Jewish humans. But it really doesn't matter very much. I mean, what's a few humans amongst others? Existentialism, atheism, lies at the heart of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler gave a special presentation to his friend Mussolini. What did he give? He gave the collected volumes of Nietzsche, the great German atheist philosopher, the man who said God is dead, the man who established that if God is dead, then all actions are meaningless, and therefore what you need to be is a person who can grasp hold of atheism properly, because the person who grasps hold of it properly and knows that life is meaningless is the person who can be the superhuman, the Superman, Hitler himself, who is not held back by moral qualms as he rules the world. Mussolini, you need to be like me, the Superman. Fascism, Nazism, Hitler is an atheist, a proper atheist, a full-blown atheist. That's the character of it. It's the same character that you find lying behind Marx in the end. But we have eternity in our hearts to say, no, it's wrong. That's not right, it's wrong. In fact, it's so wrong, it's right to go and kill that man, to stop him. This is the time to kill Hitler. That's an eternity. You see, that's a value system that's outside of this world. That's the value system which says, Nietzsche, you're wrong. There is a God. And he does hold us accountable. And we are not just a meaningless accident. We're not just the evolutionary expansion of the kind of Big Bang. There was a God who made the world, possibly by the Big Bang, possibly by evolution, but he is the one who made it all. And therefore there is eternity. But the trouble is, look at chapter 3, verse 11 again, the trouble is that we can't work out what that is. He has made everything beautiful in his time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. That's why he describes it in verse 10 as the burden that God has given us. Here is the burden. I can see clearly that it's all meaningful, purposeful, valuable. I can see that what we do actually matters. I can see that we are people who should have moral values and who do have moral values, but I can't work out what it is. I can't even agree. I can discuss with you, but I can't work them out. I don't know where it's come from and I don't know where we're going to. I just know that we're going somewhere. And that puts a great burden on us. The great burden of thought, really. Because it's unfathomable. It's like being in a maze. Ever been in a maze at a theme park somewhere or other? You know, you walk in. I mean, the one that I love is one of the very ancient ones that was set out many years ago at Hampton Court over in England. It was there at the palace that was built by Cardinal Wolsey before Henry VIII got rid of him. and took his palace from him. There is this lovely little maze outside in the gardens, and it's a hedge or series of hedges all clipped and laid out, and you pay your money and you go in there and you walk around, and as you walk around in the hedges, which are too high for you to look over and too thick for you to look through, you get lost. And you walk and you walk and you walk through this maze, and every kind of turn of the corner you look down, there's another row of hedges on your right and on your left, and at the end of it there's a hedge, and you walk down there and you turn, and there's another row of hedges on your left, on your right, and at the end it's just like that. And all around the maze there are tourists. And if you're there on a day when a Japanese bus comes, then all around there are Japanese tourists with cameras. I'm never quite sure what they're photographing inside the maze, seeing there's only hedges on your left and on your right behind you and in front of you, and other tourists photographing other tourists photographing other tourists, but there you are. Now, you know from the very structure of the maze that the thing is meaningful. You know it's purposeful. Hedges just do not grow randomly in such kind of pattern, all laid out like that. And they are certainly not growing pre-clipped like these ones. It's quite clear somebody has planted them where they have and tends them and looks after them and clips them, so the thing is totally meaningful. You can work that out. The trouble is that once you're inside it, you don't know what the meaning is. And the more you try and think it out and try and work out in your mind, okay, I've taken three to the left, now four to the right, therefore I'll take next two to the left, and the more you think it out, the less chance you've got of getting out. The people I noticed who get out fastest are children, especially under five. Basically because they run. They don't think, they just run. They just run and run and run and run and run and run, and then they yell from outside about their parents' stupidity. They're the ones who get out fastest because they don't think, but they're the ones who don't see that it's got a pattern to it, that's got a meaning to it. They just think it's fun. We older, cleverer, more mature people, we actually think it out. I've seen even people drawing little diagrams to see how they can get out. And one of the things to notice is that actually if you look over the hedge, you can see the top of the palace with beautiful Tudor chimneys, all lovely brick chimneys and marvellous things, and you can see which side that you want to go. But that only makes it worse again, doesn't it? Because it declares to you, you're right. There is an outside. The whole of the universe is not maze-like. There is an outside. You see, eternity, the outside, helps you see that there is rhyme, reason, purpose. There's something more to it than just being in the maze, but while you're in the maze, you don't know what it's about. And you're better off being one of the squirrels. Because the squirrels don't think about it either. They're just like the little children. They just run. They just run in and out and in and out, because it doesn't worry them. They don't worry about one way or another. Squirrels don't get lost in mazes. They just run in, run out. Makes no difference. It's we who have the problem. Now, life's like that. So what do you do if you're caught in a maze? If you're born in the Hampton Court maze and you've spent all your life growing up there walking around being photographed by Japanese tourists, what do you do? Well, his answer is enjoy the walk. That's what you do. See, what else can you do? I know that there's nothing, verse 12, better for men than to be happy, to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil, and this is the gift of God. We who have the problem. Now, life's like that. So what do you do if you're caught in a maze? If you're born in the Hampton Court maze and you've spent all your life growing up there walking around being photographed by Japanese tourists, what do you do? Well, his answer is enjoy the walk. That's what you do. See, what else can you do? I know that there's nothing, verse 12, better for men than to be happy, to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil, and this is the gift of God. There's nothing more to do. Just walk around, enjoy it. Look at how beautiful the different hedges have been clipped. Notice how they've grown. Notice how they've been planted in such straight line. Notice the grass that's been laid out for tourists to walk on. Enjoy the walk. Say, it's wonderful how they've given me this extra exercise that I can take my time getting around. You see, it's like being a bad golfer, isn't it? You mustn't get frustrated if you're no good at golf. Enjoy it. You see more of the course than any of the good golfers would ever see. You investigate and explore parts that a good golfer don't know exists. And what's more, you get more for your money's worth, don't you? I mean, these great golfers go around in 70 or 68, etc. 68 shots and they've done their money. 130 shots and you're still going strong. Now, who gets their value for their money? Enjoy it while you've got it, because that's all there is to it, because it doesn't make any other sense. It's just enjoyable trivia. But yet, The indications of eternity are there, mocking us all the time. God's actions go beyond the trivia because they're endurable. And these actions, verse 14, are to lead you to revere him, to seek after him, to search for him. You're right in your instinct that there is something there. And that is what you must pursue, even though you will not find him. For God's burden is there so that you will revere him, so that you will not just take the hedges for granted, the maze for granted. Yet when we look at this world and to eternity, we find a great horror. For if you go into this world with a consciousness of eternity, this world is awful. Why? Verse 16, and I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. What do you see in this world but justice perverted? I know there is a justice because there is eternity, but when I look at the very point of justice, is wickedness. There used to be a graffiti down at Central Railway Station, done away with now, I think. It was a marvellous graffiti which said, New South Wales police are the best that money can buy. The very point at which you look for justice, what do you find but wickedness? A few years ago, the Chief Stipendiary Magistrate of New South Wales and the Minister for Justice of New South Wales were both in jail for corruption. Different corruption, unrelated to each other. You wonder what they'd do if they got together. You look for justice, and what do you find? Wickedness in this world. But you say, well, there'll be a time for God's judgment, verse 17. That's all right. This world, inside the maze, is not the time for judgment. The end is the time for judgment then. God will judge in his own right time. But then that doesn't help him very much, as you'll see in verse 18. I also thought, as for men, well, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. All go to the same place, all come to dust, and to dust all return. And who knows if the spirit of man rises upward and the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth. Well, if God's testing of man, what is that testing but death? That is the only testing. For if you look into this world, he doesn't point this out, but if you look into this world, the wicked prosper in Majorca and other places like that, while the righteous seem to suffer continued bankruptcy and increased bank charges. So, I mean, it's death is where you actually see the judgment taking place. It's as you leave the maze, as you get out of this world that we actually see, but that doesn't help you because the beasts get out of this world in exactly the same fashion. The animals do. They live, they die. We live, we die. It's the beasts who we're no better than the animals. We're no different than the cockroaches, the maggots that are going to eat our bodies. We're just the same as they are. And of course, this is the thoroughly atheistic view in the end, isn't it? For if one piece of matter has evolved itself up into being you, and another piece of matter has evolved itself up into being the maggot that's going to eat you when you die, that if there's nothing more than the matter that has evolved into different fashions, then you're no better than the maggot. In fact, you'll just become part of the maggot until it exudes you. So we're just like the beasts. Ah, but hang on. The beasts, when they die, that's it. But us, when we die, go on into eternity. But he says, how do you know that? Who knows? If the spirit of man rises upwards and the beasts go down, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe when we die, we just get maggot country, but when the maggot dies, he goes to heaven. And how do you know? That the soul of the maggot is not that which rises, and the soul of the human is a figment of the twitching grey matter in your head that is wrong. How do you know? In fact, if that's the case, we're worse off than the maggot, because the maggot goes through life not conscious of eternity and therefore not worried about the injustices of the world and then goes into heaven. Whereas we go through life totally conscious of the meaningfulness of it all, only to discover it's completely meaningless. Better to be the maggot than to be the human. If that is the case, then how do you know? Verse 22, so I said, there's nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because for who can bring him to see what will happen after him? So, verse 2, he returns to the trivia. Let's enjoy the walk. Let's enjoy ourselves as we go. Famous King Song of Students, he sent Guardiam as a tutor. In translation goes, let us live then and be glad while young life before us, after youthful pastimes had, after old age hard and sad, earth will slumber o'er us. It's the same song, isn't it? Same idea as Ecclesiastes. If all I'm going to do is be under the daisies shoving them up, well, I might as well eat and drink while I can. Or if you don't want to go into Latin songs, you can go into children's nursery rhymes. Solomon Grundy, born on Monday, christened on Tuesday, married on Wednesday, took ill on Thursday, worse on Friday, died on Saturday, buried on Sunday. And this is the end of Solomon Grundy. You'll notice everything is according to time, though, isn't it? He didn't do anything on the 2 days. I mean, christened on Tuesday, it would have been the wrong time if it was Wednesday, because that was his marriage date. It all looks significant in its time, but it all heads to the same place, doesn't it? And so it's all meaningless. Well, dear friends, I can't leave you totally depressed like that. I can't take you into chapters 4 to 6, for that's next week. So let me tell you about the thing that actually gives meaning for. See, what we need is someone who has come from the grave. What we need is someone who has come from outside the maze, down from the Hampton Court Palace into the maze, you know, saying, well, friends, we're about to lock up. You've spent all week here trying to get out. Let me show you the way out. It's the person from outside who will know and make sense of the meaning of our existence, and the person who has gone out and can tell us there is an eternity outside and can come back and tell us, and there is only one like that in the end, and it's the man Jesus Christ, who was God, become man, and who died and rose again and tells us about the judgment that lies beyond the grave. Ecclesiastes attacks the lies by which people want to live. John's Gospel we're coming to in a few weeks' time, which tells us about the truth that gives rhyme and reason, explains from the beginning and the end what you cannot work out by yourself, which no one can work out by themselves, but which God makes clear in the person of Jesus. So keep coming along. Chapters 4 to 6 next week, 3 chapters you'll need to, it'd be great help if you read beforehand. On the back of the outline you'll see there's some questions just to help you kick it along. Get those white cards out, we haven't handed those white cards in yet, have we, is that right? And so if we get the cards out before you start packing up, it's really helpful because then you can drop them.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.